Okay, good morning. Today is July 22nd, 2014. This is an oral history interview with Michael Wardham. I don't think we can say we're here at the Pyle Center because we're clandestinely interviewing this. So we're somewhere on campus where we're allowed to record. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm the oral historian at UW-Madison, the UW-Madison Archives. We're going to go around and introduce ourselves because there's a few of us in the room, and we'll end with Mike. So let's start with Mario.
I'm Mario Yule. I'm an arts administrator. I'm also Robert Gard's daughter, and Mike will be talking a lot about Robert Gard. So I'll be the lead interviewer today.
Thank you.
President of?
And president of the Wisconsin, the Robert E. Gard Wisconsin Idea Foundation.
And Mario is to the right of Mike. Do you go by Mike or Michael?
Mike, please.
Okay. All right.
George Sugros, Executive Director, Wisconsin Arts Board, and board member of the Gard Foundation.
I'm Harv Thompson, and I'm a retired professor from UW-Madison Extension, and I'm also a board member of the Gard Foundation.
I'm Karen Geschko. I'm the Assistant Director at the Wisconsin Arts Board.
Ann Pryor, the Folk Arts Specialist at the Wisconsin Arts Board.
Great. Thanks to you all for coming today. Mario's going to, there's some acronyms we're going to pronounce at first to sort of help out whoever's processing this or listening to this, and then we'll go from there. So Mario.
There are probably five acronyms or phrases that you'll be hearing on the tape and or hearing as you listen to this, and let me quickly run through them. If we refer to NEA or endowment, we're referring to the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. If we refer to the Arts Board, it's the Wisconsin Arts Board. If we refer to the university or the UW, there have been different reorganizations of the University of Wisconsin system, and the most recent was after Mike left the campus. And so he or any of us who have known this institution for a long time may refer to university or UW. At that time, that referred to the Madison campus, which is now UW-Madison. Similarly, if we'd say university of or cooperative extension, it's now its own campus known as UW Extension. Fourth is, if Mike refers to the test communities, he's referring to the five small towns in the federally funded program that he'll be talking about in the second half of the interview. And if Mike refers to the professor, that will be a reference to Professor Robert E. Gard, who worked with Mike very closely. Different ones of us will be taking different of the questions, so you'll probably hear many voices on this tape. But Mike, are you ready to begin?
Yes, sir.
Wonderful. Well, so let's start by talking a little bit about you and your family background. Who were your parents? Where did they come from? How did they end up in Neillsville, Wisconsin? What do they care about?
Well, to begin with, they didn't end up in Neillsville, Wisconsin. They started there. Three quarters of my family was from Neillsville. They had immigrated there fairly early and lived there all their lives. And then my parents lived there all their lives. My mother was a high school teacher. She and her twin sister graduated from here, the University of Wisconsin, and got their master's here in the early 30s. And my mother's major was Latin, but she ended up teaching math mostly. And was also, when I think about her, she was very committed to continuing education, continuing to learn. She was always taking some kind of a class or doing some new craft or something, a very inquiring mind. My dad was an electrician. In fact, he was the only electrician in town and did things like wired the high school, wired the muffler plant, wired the hospital, and so on. He always charged $2 an hour. And finally, after I'd come down here to school and discovered that electricians were making $22 an hour here, I gave him a pep talk, and so during his last years, he raised his rate to $3 an hour. But he was very interesting. He was a great outdoorsman, a great naturalist, for many years a great hunter until he finally outgrew that. And they were just very middle class, very conservative in some ways. They had both come through the Depression, so they were very concerned with security and so on, and basically had a good life, lived 80 plus years in that little town, which I find kind of horrible, but...
All in the same house?
Oh, not all in the same house, no. No, they finally, their great achievement was they built a house and had rented up until the time they built it and saved enough money to pay for the house. My dad's proudest moment was when Big Nose Peterson, the insurance man in town, accosted him on the street one day and asked him if he didn't need mortgage insurance. And my dad said, "We don't have a mortgage." So they never bought anything on time. It was always, cars were always paid for and so on. So that's who they were.
So they valued thrift, good solid small town people who had come through the Depression.
Yes.
So when did you come onto the scene? When were you born?
I was born November 28th, 1940. It was Thanksgiving Day. And I'm told that the icicles, it was a terribly hard winter, and the icicles went way down to the ground on places. I was born in what was then the Neillsville Hospital, which was an old house. And it happened that there was somebody else about to give birth at the same time. So there was one delivery room. And the other lady was using the delivery room when my mother got ready to deliver. So she had to wrap blankets around her and run upstairs to the operating room so that they could deliver the baby. And that's where the beginnings came from.
And maybe that's a foreshadowing of things that come later in your life, I don't know.
Difficult deliveries, yes, indeed.
So tell us a little bit about, not your schooling yet, we'll talk about that in a minute, but just as a kid growing up in Neillsville, what did your parents expect of you? Did they assume you would have the same values as they would, the same high standards of thrift? What did they expect of you?
Those things, definitely. They were very upset when I left home to move to the West Coast, because people just didn't do that kind of thing. They had very high expectations of me. I don't remember ever thinking anything other than that I would go to college. I didn't have any idea what I would do. I envisioned myself as carrying a briefcase and going to an office, and that was about as far as it went, but it was always assumed that I was going to college. If I had had any sense, I would have stayed home and taken over my father's electrical business and started charging a fair amount for my services, and I'd be a very rich man today. But that wasn't the way things worked out.
So were you church-going people? Did you have, your mother talked about getting involved, you talked about your mom getting involved in a lot of crafts and a lot of interests. Did you share those interests? Did you get involved in those craft things too?
Yeah, pretty much. I remember my mother got an enthusiasm at one point for making rosaries. She sent off to a place in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where they were wholesale rosary suppliers. And so she and I sat there bending these little wires and making thousands of rosaries. I took part in all that kind of thing.
So does that mean you were a Catholic family?
Well, not a family. My mother was Catholic. My father, difficult to say what he would have been. He always said that the Presbyterian Church had burned down when he was a boy, and they never rebuilt it. So he always told everyone he was a Presbyterian because that meant he didn't have to do anything. It was just kind of came to the Catholicism through the back door. My mother's mother married a railroad mail clerk from Fond du Lac who died within 18 months after they were married, after she had the twins. And he was Irish, and his family were Catholic, and so my grandmother ended up raising the children in his memory in the Catholic Church, and so that was how we ended up being Catholic.
This is Harv asking next question. Did you have brothers or sisters, Mike?
No, I was an only child.
Okay.
And which I think is unfortunate. There was this great fad a few years ago of everybody having one child. And I lectured everybody I knew who was in that position saying that they should avoid that if at all possible, because you never learn to fight and you never learn to share. And you end up almost invariably, or I did, I shouldn't say everybody, but end up very self-centered without knowing it. It just doesn't occur to me that I could be any other way. I've made some strides in that direction thanks to my life partner, who would not put up with my self-centeredness. But it was a very difficult transition and a very difficult learning experience.
Well, Mike, tell us a little bit about your school years through high school.
I went to St. Mary's Catholic Grade School in Neillsville, and I was very lucky in that at that time the teachers there were School Sisters of Notre Dame, and they had a requirement that everybody that was going to teach, to be a teaching nun, had to have a bachelor's degree at least. This was in the days when public schools were being taught mostly, not mostly, but largely, by people who had two-year teaching degrees. And so the depth of education was better, at least in my opinion it was better. And so I had a really good background going into high school. The other thing that was fortunate was that every twice a week, once, I can't remember when Professor Gordon was on, but once a week, Professor Edgar Gordon had a program on WHA, and the sister would put the FM radio on the desk, go to the back of the room, and we'd all have our music lesson from Professor Gordon. All had song books that had been sent out by extension, and all sang. Professor Gordon had the whole state singing. Then on Wednesday afternoons, Jim Schwalbach would come on with Let's Draw, and we'd have our drawing lesson. So I got some music and some art, visual art skills right from the beginning.
Mike, what kind of kid were you? What really interested you during your school years?
Well, kind of kid. A couple of things happened. One is I was dyslexic. And of course, then I didn't find out until I was 22. Nobody knew about such things. So I had pretty severe learning difficulty. I couldn't read. Well, I couldn't tell time, I couldn't tie a bow knot, all that kind of thing. And then I also, because my birthday is so late in the year, my mother lobbied the school district to let me start kindergarten, what turned out to be too early. I was 4 when I started kindergarten, so I never really got properly socialized. And so there, I had certain difficulties. As a result of this, I ended up being painfully shy and scared of everything and everybody, and was kind of, in some ways, kind of a loner because of that. I also somehow, and it may have been those early craft things of my mother's and the fact that she read to me aloud until I was about 12, which was very, very good thing. I was a culture vulture. I was just absolutely interested in all kinds of cultural things. And in those days, it was kind of difficult to get that need satisfied because there was no cable TV, there was no, didn't have the kind of music access that we have nowadays and so on. So I was kind of a loner. I was a kind of a misfit. I had a lot of trouble relating to other people until I was about a senior in high school. So it was kind of a average but lonely childhood.
Were there one or two people, as you're thinking about it now, who come to mind who really influenced you and it's still with you today?
Yes, absolutely. There's not a day goes by, but when I think of my high school Latin, English, and history teacher, I remember my grandmother saying, "Boy, you're taking three classes from that woman this year. I hope you don't have a falling out somewhere along the line." Harriet Hosley was a graduate of University of Wisconsin, and just a magnificent teacher. And there were others as well. There was Patricia Grady, who was another of my English teachers. Daphne Beekler, who was my English and speech teacher. Earl Reedy, who was the guidance counselor and American government teacher. Those people all had a great influence on me. And I suspect it's why when I came to the, well, I don't suspect, I know that it's why when I came to the University of Wisconsin, I majored in English and speech.
So this is Karen. Was it obvious that you were bound for the University of Wisconsin when you graduated from high school?
Well, I had two choices, and I've always kind of been amazed at the fact that I only had two choices. The only places I considered as places to go were Eau Claire State College, which was about 50 miles from home, and the University of Wisconsin. And I never crossed my mind to go to a private school. I never thought about that. Never crossed my mind to go out of state. They just weren't in my parameters. I debated back and forth whether to do one or the other. And finally, a woman named Alice Zesky, who was a substitute librarian at the high school that year, I was talking to her about it, and she said, "Well," she said, "I'll tell you, the difference between going to Eau Claire and the University of Wisconsin is the difference between being a commentator and a news reporter." And I've never forgotten that. And it was one of the things that pushed me to the university. Plus the fact that my favorite teacher had graduated from here. My mother and aunt had graduated from here. So that was how I ended up here at Wisconsin.
I heard you say you were sort of destined for the English department. Were you interested in the arts per se at that point?
Yeah, I was, like I said, I was kind of a culture vulture. And so when I got here, I keep saying here, meaning University of Wisconsin campus, which is where we are at the moment, I availed myself of all the cultural opportunities. Didn't have any money. I lived on about $1,000 a year. But I made room for all the cultural events. When I look back on it, I had some magnificent opportunities. And Robert Frost came and did reading. Eleanor Roosevelt came and spoke at the Student Union Theater. Betty Davis and Gary Merrill did readings from Sandberg. Helen Hayes and Maurice Evans came and did Shakespeare readings. Catherine Cornell and Brian Ahern did Dear Liar, the play about George Bernard Shaw. And it was just unbelievably enriching. It was a wonderful thing to experience.
This is Mario. If I can just jump in, I remember, Mike, that you talked about Hedda Gabler. And I think, was that when you were still in high school?
Yes.
I think that might be illuminating, because you refer to it a lot.
My father was the president of the Rotary Club. And I found out later, it was after I started working for Professor Gard, I discovered that this particular event that my father was involved in was sponsored by Wisconsin Idea Theater. And it was a group of students from University of Michigan who were going around the state presenting plays. And so the professor or somebody from the university talked my dad into sponsoring Hedda Gabler. And so it was in the high school gym, and all the family was there, fairly close. It was the worst production anyone could ever imagine. It was just abysmal, you know. Had his hair looked like it came out of a beehive. Her love interest was in this horrible brown tweed suit that didn't fit him. It was just, and then everything that went wrong, technically, of course, went wrong. My father always said afterwards that theater was dead and Hedda Gabler was what killed it. But all that being said, it was magic. I mean, it's the first thing I'd ever seen that wasn't a high school play. My first experience at professional theater, and I've never forgotten it. It was just, to me, it's absolute proof that all these arguments about quality and professionalism don't mean a thing. That it's what you as the viewer bring to the production. It's what makes it stand out in your memory. I have no difficulty saying that it was a terrible production, but it simply was. But that didn't make a whit of difference. It was life changing.
So Anne, I think you had a question.
Yes. And I also have a couple of follow-up that I want to ask before we leave Neillsville and really dive deep into your time at Madison. Could you tell us what your mother's name and your father's names are?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry I didn't do that. Maida Quinlan Warlam and Elliot Clarence Warlam.
Okay, great. Yeah. And you said that your people immigrated to Neillsville. From where?
Well, the Warlams came from Wilmer, Minnesota. They were from around Oslo originally. And of course, you know how the Scandinavian names work. They didn't really have their own names. It was son, 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 son. And they were peasants, and so they didn't have a last name, really. So they bought a farm in Wilmer, Minnesota, and the people that owned the farm before them's name was Warlam, and so they adopted the name. I've never met a Warlam that wasn't a relative. It's probably the most unusual six-letter name in the English language. You just don't run into Warlams. The people on the other side of my father's family came from Germany. And as far as I know, they settled in that immediate area as soon as they came over. My mother's mother was born there, and her family had immigrated from Germany to the southern part of Wisconsin. I think it was Hortonville, someplace like that. And then they eventually moved there to Neillsville. And my mother's father's family were from Fond du Lac, and as I said, he was a railroad mail carrier. So he came through on the train, courted my grandmother and married her, and then died. Mm-hmm. And when he died, his family had no more to do with. They left my grandmother to raise the twins completely on her own and had nothing to do with them from then on. And then when they graduated from high school, she wanted to show them that she'd done this whole thing without them. So she sent them an invitation to the graduation, and they came. So she had to put them up and feed them and so on. But I don't really know much about them other than that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for filling in those.
And can I?
Yeah.
Before we get to college. I mean, you mentioned earlier you grew up with a learning disability. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the history of dyslexia, so I don't even know if dyslexia was a term at that point.
It wasn't. It wasn't.
But I'm wondering, how did you overcome, may not be the right word, but how did you manage it or deal with it growing up?
Well, I think probably not knowing about it was helpful, as weird as that sounds. Because what I did instead, I remember years later being home for Christmas and saying to my mother that it must have been very difficult for she and my father to raise me when I had this handicap, so to speak. And she said, "Oh, well, you just had to learn to work hard." And I think that was right, that I learned to study carefully. I learned to apply myself strong to things. There are things still that can be a problem. I mean, I can't tell right from left, for one thing. I had an eye removed when I was a freshman in college, and so I thought, oh great, that now I'll always know what's right and left, because all I have to do is close my eyes. And then I promptly forgot which eye it was. You know, so there are difficulties that I have still, but I think after I left Wisconsin and was working in Indiana, the chairman of the Arts Commission, where I was the executive director, and his wife were dyslexic and had three dyslexic children, and so he was a businessman who had sold his business and for a great deal of money, and so they started investing the money in various things. And one of the things they did was start a school for dyslexic children. And Frank Thomas said to me at one point, he said, "You're okay because you were bright." He said, "Some of the kids that we deal with in our school are average or a little bit below average," and he said, "some of them just cease to function. They just can't cope." And so then I realized I, thank gosh, was afforded the privilege of having a pretty good sound mind. And so I could overcome a lot of this stuff. And as I say, part of it was not knowing about it. I'll never forget, I was working for Extension already, and I was driving across northern Wisconsin one day listening to WHA, of course, never listened to anything else. And there was a lecture on about this new disease. And they started talking about things like people couldn't tie their shoes, people couldn't tell time. And all of a sudden, I realized he was talking about me. And I felt this great weight go off me, because it wasn't my fault. I had a disease. And it was a great satisfaction to learn that it wasn't simply because I was inferior, it was because there was something wrong with the wiring.
One more thing, sorry, but I know we're actually ahead of time. So you called yourself a loner, but I have to, well, you can debunk me if I'm wrong, but I have to think you had some friends growing up, and I wonder if some of them stand out in your mind.
Oh, thank you. That's a good question. Yeah, I did. I had a very close friend in grade school named Bobby Hopfer, who we did everything together when we were little kids. And then in high school, I developed some friendships toward the end, toward the last year in high school. The other people that stand out were the little girls that lived next door when I was growing up, the Balam girls. And we played together all the time, and there's still one of the girls lives in Black River. And we still, in our Christmas cards, refer to each other as brother and sister. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there were people. I made it sound a little more dismal than it actually was.
You know, sometimes people in small communities never really leave. When you were growing up, did you see much of the world? Did you see much of Wisconsin?
I really did. We traveled quite a bit. I remember going to North Carolina at one point to visit my grandmother's sister, and to Virginia at one point to visit the same sister, and to Florida at one point. And so, yeah, we got out and around some. We used to big shopping trips to Eau Claire and bigger shopping trips to Minneapolis. Used to go to the Minnesota State Fair and so on. So, yeah, I did get around some. But this thing about people staying in small towns, I went back to my 35th high school reunion, and I was amazed at the number of people that had never left home.
So we're about to take a little break. Is there anything you'd want to add about your growing up years before we do that?
No. I think we've pretty well covered it, probably more exhaustively than I should have.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah. We'll be back in 5.
I'm sorry about that. I just...
All right. So this is Anne. Tell us a little bit about your undergraduate years, your education, the classes, the professors, experiences that made a difference for you?
Yes, yeah. Well, to begin with, I was terrified. I came from a high school of 300 souls to a university that at that time was 17,000 people and felt totally lost. I also began to get the inklings of realizing that anonymity is a great thing. You know, that suddenly I wasn't constrained by the town of 2,500 people, all of whom knew me. And suddenly I felt a great sense of freedom going on. I was absolutely convinced that I would flunk out, because this was way too big a challenge for me. And then to make matters more difficult, I had to have an eye removed when in October of my freshman year. And so I knew there was no question but what I was going to flunk out and end up going home on what my mother always referred to as the sore eye special. And so I worked very hard, and I got a 3.5 grade point that first semester, just because I was terrified into studying. I mentioned the cultural opportunities, which were wonderful. As far as professors that were memorable for me, one was Professor Helen White in the English department. I was privileged to have a whole year of Shakespeare from her, and I've never forgotten how Dr. White always lectured with a hat. I never was seen without a hat, except one day she came in without a hat, and I couldn't look at her through the whole lecture because it was like seeing her nude, you know. And she always wore She always wore green or purple, and there were many legends about why Helen White wore green or purple. One was that she was actually of royal blood. One was that she had an audience with the Pope and was wearing a purple dress, and he commented on how nice it was, so she always wore purple. The fact of the matter, as she revealed to us in class one day, she wore green and purple because that way everything always matched. Mm. So the other person who was truly memorable and probably the biggest influence on me in my undergraduate career was Dr. Gladys Borchers in the speech department. She really took me under her wing and really helped me get through. She was my advisor, and I had the chance to take several classes from her, and really, she really had a great effect on me. And there were others, of course, but those are the two that stand out.
Was that your major then, speech?
I had a double major, English and speech.
Okay. And what years were you here?
I started in 58. I got my bachelor's in 62. I got my master's in 64. And I got my doctorate in January 67.
Okay.
Can I ask, what made Helen White and Gladys Borchers great teachers? I mean, what were the elements of that?
I think the biggest element, first of all, they were good speakers, but the biggest element is that they taught by relating things to their own personal experiences. They were both great storytellers. And I, as a result of that, I'm sure it's a result of that, I developed that teaching style for myself. And later on, when I was my last few years, I spent I started my own business and was doing seminars to businesses around the country, and I discovered that there are a lot of people who don't relate to that method of teaching at all. They want it right from the book and line by line, and I got to the point where when people would complain about that, I'd say, well, you go back in the corner and read the book, and don't pay any attention to what I'm saying, because this is the way I do it. That teaching through relating. I don't believe anybody learns anything unless it can somehow hook into their own experience. You just don't learn otherwise. And so that was, anyway, that's a long way of saying what they were about.
What were your master's and doctoral degrees in?
Adult education with an emphasis in community arts development.
For both?
Yes,
of those degrees. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the years that you were here, especially your later ones, were fairly tumultuous on the UW-Madison campus. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, they were. I left here just maybe 2 months before the Sterling Hall bombings. But it was a very heady time here, and I was affected by it without knowing it. I developed, apparently, I've never considered myself this way, but other people seem to, a very liberal outlook and a very liberal viewpoint on things. And it developed so subtly that it was something that I just never questioned. I mean, it never occurred to me that one shouldn't have that viewpoint. At that time, also, University of Wisconsin was a great party school. And I remember when I was in the latter part of graduate school, sitting in the barbershop over on State Street, reading Playboy magazine, which I read only for the articles, of course. But they had an article about the 10 top party schools in the nation. And University of Wisconsin was number one. And I realized at that point that after being here for 10 years, I had never been to a party. You know, I think that I missed a great deal of the opportunity of a campus like this because I studied. I mean, I was completely wrapped up in studying in the books. And when I think back, I missed a great experience, a great deal of what was going on, you know. But yeah, I was affected by the liberal attitudes of the campus, thank goodness.
You were describing before this conversation started that you had an apartment on State Street?
Yes, that's right.
Can you say something about campus life and living on State Street?
Oh, yes. When I was an undergraduate, before that, I lived over on Clymer Place, which does not exist anymore. They built a whole series of dorms there, but I lived in a rooming house. There were eight boys in the rooming house, and it was run by a pair of Irish old maids, and they kept us in line and mothered us and so on, you know. Nobody, as far as I remember, nobody in the house ever dated. The big recreation was going to a movie on Saturday at either the Orpheum or the Capitol Theater, and once in a while, we'd go over to a bar. It was an Italian bar over here on University Avenue. I can't remember the name of it now, but we'd have a beer once in a while, and that was about the extent of the social life. Of course, it was an easy walk to campus from there. And then when I started graduate school, I started graduate school because I received a National Defense Act Fellowship in adult education, which paid $2,000 a year. Well, I was in hog heaven, you know. I drove a Thunderbird, which my parents bought me. I had my own apartment. I mean, I was living large. The apartment that I had was at 444 Hawthorne Court, and it was above next door above Brown's Bookstore. And the Italian Village restaurant was downstairs, and I think Redwood and Ross was the haberdasher that was downstairs. And it was a tiny one-room apartment with a Murphy bed. And it was just wonderful. I loved being there. I lived there all the way through graduate school.
So as an undergraduate then, you said you majored in?
English and speech.
English and speech. But you went to graduate school in adult education. How did that transition come about?
Well, I was all set to teach English and speech at the high school level. That was my ambition.
After you just got your BA.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I was planning eventually to come back for a master's, perhaps. Then about April of my senior year, I got a letter in the mail from the adult education people in the School of Education, saying that they had National Defense Act fellowships available. And the man who ended up being my major professor, Burton Kreitlow, had found out about the National Defense Education Act and decided that it'd be a wonderful idea to apply for fellowships for people in adult education. And they had granted fellowships before this, and they had all been granted to people. Mostly it was, the department was made up mostly of cooperative extension people, people who had been county agents and home agents and so on. And so the mean age in the department at that point was 30. And they decided, they being Professor Kreitlow and Professor Robert Boyd and Wilson Thede, decided that wouldn't it be a great idea to get young blood into the department. What would happen if they bring in somebody directly out of undergraduate school who didn't have any experience? So I I thought, well, gee, I didn't even know what adult education was. I mean, I knew it had something to do with vocational schools, and that was exactly all I knew. But here was a fellowship for a PhD. And so I applied for it, and it turned out, as far as I know, I was the only undergraduate, and they had sent the letter to people graduating in the School of Education who had a 3.25 average or above. I had exactly a 3.25. I was the only undergraduate that applied. Well, I went in for the interview, terrified, of course, and they said, we want you to take a test called the Miller Analogies. Well, I knew nothing, I never heard of the Miller Analogies. And so I thought, you know, what the heck, I don't have anything to lose. So I went and took the test, and it was kind of fun. I mean, it was all things that kind of twisted your mind around, and I had a good time with the test and so on. Well, I never knew what I scored. But after that, every time one of these professors would introduce me to another one, he'd say, this is the guy who took the Miller Analogies. So I must have done pretty well on it. Anyway, I got the fellowship, and that's how I came to be in graduate school.
So what did you learn that the field of adult education was? You entered it not having a clue what it was, and what is it? And tell us about your graduate school years.
I think adult education departments have pretty much stopped. I think they're pretty well extinct. They don't seem to have them anymore in colleges and universities. But what I learned was that adult education is everything. It's the whole reason we are adults, because we have that capacity to keep learning. And it began to open up for me, and I began to see all these possibilities. The department here at the university was staffed mostly by people who had been in the Cooperative Extension Service, and the emphasis, therefore, was very much on community development. And so,
and rural community development, particularly, if they were in Cooperative Extension?
Oh, I suppose, yeah. I suppose so. They didn't limit themselves that way, but yeah, the background and experience that they'd had and that they transmitted to us in class was pretty much rural sociology kind of bent. And so I discovered, and then the other thing, they'd never had anybody, well, that's not true. They'd had very few people before whose major thrust was the arts and interest in the arts. And so we were able to put together a program for me that involved both community development and arts management and arts development. And so that's how that came about.
Well, and before we hear more about that, you talked about Burton Kreitlow, and having been a friend of yours for many years, you still talk about Dr. Kreitlow.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about him and why he was so important to you?
Dr. Kreitlow was a great man. I had started out in graduate school being advised by Robert Boyd. And Boyd's interest in getting somebody unexperienced into the program was that he wanted to train them as a pure researcher, because the strength that he brought to the department was scientific research. And it became very clear very quickly that there was no way in the world that I was ever going to be a researcher. It's just not where my interests lie. At the end of the first year of graduate school, the end of the first year of graduate school, I took my master's exam. It was a 4-hour written exam at the time. And I wrote for 4 hours, and I'm a fairly good writer, and so it was not a big problem. I thought I'd done fine. and the results came out and I'd flunked. Which, you know, thoughts of suicide followed by thoughts of dropping out of school followed by total inadequacy, you know, and so on. And so there was a very wise secretary in the department, and she said to me, she said, you need to go and talk to the people that were on that committee and find out why they flunked you. And so I went to one person. He said, well, he said, you were okay, but it just didn't quite measure up. It just didn't quite measure, which was, I mean, a heck of a lot of help, right? Then I went to see Walter Brocker over in Ag and Extension Education. Never had met him before. And I walked into his office and he looked up and he said, who are you? And I said, I'm the guy that flunked the master's exam. And he looked at me and he said, how old are you? And I said, well, I'm 20. And he said, well, why didn't somebody tell me? He said, I marked you down because you didn't bring any experience to bear. He said, you haven't had any experience, have you? And I said, no, I haven't. I came in right out of undergraduate school. So at that point, Robert Boyd, who had figured out by now that I was not going to be a researcher, declared that he would no longer be my advisor or my major professor. And so Kreitlow inherited me. And he was, in many ways, like Professor Gard, in that he trusted his students to do the right thing. And so he guided me along and helped me make up a program that would satisfy both the adult education and the arts development kind of needs.
So was he the guy that encouraged you to stay in school, not commit suicide, drop out, and all those other things?
No, I guess I figured that out on my own. The real turning point was this secretary saying, go and see these people, because I that had not occurred to me. You know, I just felt totally bereft at that point. And that kind of turned me around and helped me at that point.
That's great. So Mike, George, with the next question, and it goes to the community arts development portion of your studies. It's been said that you got the first community arts development degree. How'd you come to that notion of getting a degree in community arts development? Who helped you down that path? And were the rest of the people, as you're talking about advisors, et cetera, were they supportive of that path?
Yes, yeah, they were supportive of it, which I thinking back on it, I give them great credit for that, because it wasn't within their particular realm of experience at that point. In fact, it didn't, officially as a field, didn't exist. After I flunked the master's exam and after my professors found out about the fact that experience was something I lacked, they farmed me out to various people in extension to gain some experience, a very sensible thing to do. And I being on this fellowship, I was not allowed to work. And so they decided that I would volunteer 10 hours a week at various places. I went with Fred Haug from the our speech extension to a weekly class in Milwaukee, which he was teaching to union members. And then the next semester, they found out about Professor Gard. I shouldn't say found out, they knew him, but it hadn't occurred to them that this would be a good place for me. And so they put me in touch with Professor Gard, and I started working for him at that point. And kind of out of that experience came this idea of getting a degree in community arts development.
Mike, in that era, this is Harv speaking, it seems to me that sometimes graduate students helped inform the faculty and helped teach them new possibilities, such as
a combined doctoral degree instead of a single department. Did you feel at that time that you in fact were teaching them and kind of guiding them to think differently too?
Well, I think it would be kind of hubris for me to say that. I don't know how to answer that. I didn't feel like I was teaching anybody anything. I felt very grateful that they allowed me to pretty much design my own program. That was a very lucky thing, and it was a very hit and miss thing. I didn't realize it at the time. In fact, I didn't realize it until I was preparing for these interviews and thinking about my life as a whole, that experience of being completely on my own, being the only one of my type in graduate school, helped me a great deal in the jobs that I had subsequently. Like when we were doing the Arts in a Small Community grant program, we were making it up as we went along. When I went to direct the Indiana Arts Commission, I had to set up the state agency and get it operating, so it was all new. And I think I credit the fact that I had this unique program in graduate school and flying by the seat of my pants through all that with what gave me the ability to do those other jobs.
Did you have classes in the arts when you were in graduate school, or was that really based on your previous experience?
Pretty much based on my previous experience, and then of course the experience of working with Professor Gard made it possible mm-hmm. to do it.
Right. Well, we'll get into your meeting of Professor Gard and that whole period in a moment, but why don't we take another break at this point, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Thanks, Mike.
I'm terribly sorry for this.
So we know that Professor Gard was a huge influence on the rest of your career, but before we talk about that period in your life, I think people around the table have some follow-up questions. And Anne, do you want to just jump in?
I'm describing this adult education program in your graduate years. Where were the classes on campus? What buildings were you in primarily?
Principally, the education building, halfway up the hill. Over here, that was where the majority of the classes took place.
Okay.
So I know Troy has some questions.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that, because you just referenced the education building. You talked about apartments on State Street mm-hmm. and other places, but where were some other places on campus that you either studied or spent time in?
The student union for one place. The student union was. Was a wonderful place and a very friendly place to hang out. A lovely place, the Raskeller, and I actually went, before I left Wisconsin, I bought a life membership in the union, which I have in my pocket right now, actually. The union was one place. Also, interestingly enough, at the top of the hill near the observatory, which right where the Robert Gard story circle now is, I used to go there, and there were benches, and I used to go there and study. When I was here at summer school, I spent the great majority of my time behind the union on the grass. Overlooking the lake, that was a terrific place to study in the summertime, and so those were the places that stand out in my mind.
Thank you, and we've talked about a few professors. What about some of your cohorts, either undergraduate or graduate students, that stand out in your mind?
There are some. Paul Butterfield is one. Paul Butterfield was from Utah, and came here. He was the year before me in the National Defense Fellowships. Came with a wife and five children, being a good Latter-day Saints person. And then they had a sixth child while they were here. And so here they were living on, I think the fellowship made a little allowance for families. So I think Paul was getting maybe $4,500 a year. So he was trying to raise a family on $4,500 a year. And here I was, like I said, living large on $2,000. And so I began to realize how lucky I was at that point. Paul was a great friend. There was Jim Long, who was from Oregon originally. Several people like that in graduate school. The person that really stands out to me from those graduate school years is a guy named Donald Reedy, who was the son of that guidance counselor and American government teacher that I mentioned earlier. Don and I were like, he was 2 years younger than I, and we were like brothers when we were in high school. And then he went to River Falls for his undergraduate degree in art, and then transferred to the university here for graduate school. And so he and I hung out a lot and had great experiences in being graduate students. We used to go to Glenn and Ann's Cozy Corner over on John, I think it's on Johnson, by the Kohl Center. Now it's in the building is still there. And so Don and I did a nostalgia tour a few years ago. I was here for a conference that Mario had sponsored. And so Don drove. Don has recently retired as a full professor from the University of Wisconsin, and he taught for 30 years, taught art at the center in Rice Lake. And so Don drove down here. We made a little nostalgia tour. And we got over to Johnson, and here was the building, Glenn and Ann's Cozy Corner. Glenn and Ann were from Stratford originally. And so it was like being in a central Wisconsin bar, which made us right at home. And so we walked in. It's now some kind of a fancy sports bar or something. So we walked in, and the young lady says, "Can I help you?" And we said, "Yeah, the bar is supposed to be over there, and the restrooms are over here. What have you done with this place?" You know? So the one thing that we found that hadn't changed was we walked up State Street, and there was a restaurant up there that had a tree in the middle of the restaurant. I can't remember the name of the place, but we walked in, and the bartender came up to us, and we ordered a beer, and we, of course, immediately, two old duffers, you know, coming in there, "Well, we used to hang out here when we were, you know," and like she hadn't heard that 800 times that day. And I said, "Yeah, and we really remember this tree." And she said, "Yeah, I suppose you both threw up under it, you know."
I do have a couple more, but I think, Karen, you said you might have one. I don't want to just monopolize the whole section. So.
I heard you say that developing your own or designing your own program was kind of a hit or miss proposition. What were some of the misses?
How do you mean that? You mean that things I should have taken that I didn't?
What did you try that didn't work? Or when you look back, what was like, "Oh, why did I spend time with that?" Or, "Oh, that was worth it, the experience, but it didn't really work out as I expected."
Gosh. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I for one thing, it's a million years ago. But also, I can't think of anything that I did that I regretted doing. No, I don't know. I really don't know.
Great. Yeah. Thanks.
Before we go back to Troy, I also had a question. You said that there were a lot of cooperative extension people on your program faculty. Did they ever take you out in the field with them? Did you go with an extension agent out to rural Baraboo and interact with people out there, or was this pretty much an on-campus program?
It was on campus. Of course, these people who were teaching the program's background, or a couple of them's background, was cooperative extension, but of course they were full professors at that point, so they were occupied here. The one experience that I did have like that, which I hope we'll get into a little later, is when I was sent to Hurley to work on the National Finnish American Festival. There I worked with a man who was an absolute consummate community developer, Herb Kinney, who was the county agent in Iron County. And I had my desk in his area, and really learned how wonderful cooperative extension, I don't know if it still is, but in those days it was a wonderful institution.
What were the elements that made it wonderful to you?
The main thing, I think, was the realization that it really made it true that the boundaries of the university are the boundaries of the state. Those people, the county agent, the 4-H agent, the home agent, had direct access to the university. I think, if I remember correctly, I think the county agents were actually faculty, had faculty status. And so here we were, as far away in the state as you could get from University of Wisconsin, and they had a direct tie-in, and Herb, at least, was absolutely dedicated to developing the community. What had happened up there shortly before I moved up there was the Shaft Iron Mines had closed because of the taconite boom in Minnesota. And the lumber industry was at a long-time ebb, and the unemployment was about 24%. And there were only 109 bars left on Silver Street, and only three of those had entertainers. And he was dedicated to finding ways to revitalize and broaden the economy. And I don't think that area would have survived as well as it has if not for his efforts.
So you had a lot of people who influenced you on campus and off with a really holistic approach to the community, it sounds like.
Yes, 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 exactly.
That's great. Troy, did you have some questions?
Yeah, I have two more. So it behooves me to ask about one national event and one local event and kind of get your impressions of them since you were on campus for both. So
sure.
The national event was the assassination of JFK in November 1963.
Yeah, yeah. It could be yesterday. I can remember that vividly. I was having lunch with my friend Ora Berry, who had been Professor Gard's secretary at Troya's over on University Avenue. We were eating, I was eating at least a steak sandwich, and this news came over the television that the president had been shot. And then the news came over that he was dead. And I remember going back to my apartment and just sitting there. It was just unfathomable, just unbelievable. And then I went to the evening mass, I guess it was about 6 o'clock, at the Newman Center. And the church was just packed with people, and all utter silence. And then later on, I was over at the Union and saw on television Jack Ruby killing Harvey Oswald. And then, of course, the whole funeral thing going on. And at that time, I was working for Professor Gard, and we were preparing the Milwaukee Folk Fair. He, Professor Gard, directed the show at the Milwaukee Folk Festival. And so we were just about ready. It was always, that was like Thanksgiving weekend, I think, as I recall. And we were just getting ready to go down there, and here was this horrible thing happening. And I remember saying to him, well, are they going to cancel the folk fair then? And he said, no. He said, people have worked on it for a year. He said, we can't cancel it. But he wrote a tribute then, so that before they started the show in the Milwaukee Arena Auditorium, there was a tribute to the president before that happened, before the show happened. But yeah, it was a profoundly influential and moving thing for all of us that lived at that time.
Thank you. And then the local event is, I guess, what I and others consider the start of the really hot period of campus protest, and it started with the Dow riot in October of 1967. So first, were you on campus that day?
Yeah, I was here until July of 69. So yeah, I was on faculty here. And it sounds really snobbish to say it, but when you were on faculty, you were in a slightly removed place, so I didn't have to take part in the riots. But I remember crossing University Avenue one day down there by the First National Bank, and seeing this whole crowd coming down in parade, filling University Avenue. And then the other thing I remember, I used to park out at what I suppose is long gone, Lot 66, which was where the faculty parked. And it was out there kind of in the direction of where University Hospitals now is at. And the entire parking lot was wreathed with tanks, because the National Guard was here in case they were needed and so on. And I remember thinking how horrible it was that it had come to this, that the government felt that it needed to send in troops to deal with it. But and then I remember one time I was going with a girl who lived at a private dorm on Johnson, and there was a riot down in that section of town one night, and I was living out on Lake Monona at the time. And I drove down and picked her and the girl in the next apartment up and took them back to my place, because we were afraid of looting and so on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a difficult time. I had one friend who was 6'3", and he simply went home, because he said if he stood in a crowd, yeah, he was the one that was going to catch the bullet if they shot over people's heads, so he just went home.
Thank you for that.
Mike, I have a question. It's out of sequence for where we've just been, but since we've been talking about from your birth to your undergraduate, early graduate years, when you moved to Madison to start undergraduate work, did you continue relying on folks at home, Neillsville community? Did you go back there often? When did you become yourself away from Neillsville?
Oh, that's a good question. At first, I went home quite a bit. It was no small feat in those days, because it was 150 miles, and it meant riding on the Greyhound bus, heaven forbid. But I got home a number of weekends, and of course, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and spring break, went home, and then summers. I worked with my dad in the summer as his gopher, and so I was still quite attached to the community, and a lot of my friends were still there, and so on. And then, along about my junior year, I needed to, I think it was a Chaucer class that I hadn't had a chance to take and wanted to take, and it was being offered in the summer. And so I stayed down here for summer school. Well, that's all she wrote. I mean, because from then on, I made up excuses for why I needed to go to summer school and became more and more a citizen of the university. And I suppose there, then and thereafter, when I was in graduate school, I always managed to have a paper due right after Christmas vacation. So I'd go home for 2 or 3 days and then come back here. And I don't know how many people experience it, but I discovered that Madison, during the breaks, was absolute heaven, because you had the place to yourself. You know, there wasn't a huge population of students around, and it was just, you really could, I at least was able to really get acquainted with the community and the surroundings, and it was a very nice, I remember that very fondly, very nice time. Summer school also was heaven, thank God. Lived behind the Union on the pier.
So I have one quick final question, and then we'll take a break and move on to your time with Professor Gard. There was a arts administration program in the business department, and I don't know if that existed when you were here or not, and did you ever flirt with being a part of that program?
No, I didn't. It was just getting underway. And that's why people have said I had the first degree in arts administration. That's not true. Fam Taylor, who ran the program, graduated somebody before I graduated in arts administration. I have no idea whatever happened to him. Yeah, that program was in the business division, and I'm sure people listening to the recording know about Fan Taylor, because she was quite a force at the university, and later with the National Endowment. She worked as the music director for the National Endowment for some years. Fran was basically a facilities manager, and so her program was pretty much concentrated on managing a hall or managing an arts facility, and so it was quite a different thing from what I was interested in.
That's great. Well, thank you. We'll be back in a few minutes and move into the next stage in your life.
Okay.
Thank you, Mike.